Well, what's it going to be? A boy or a girl? A prince or a princess? The Duchess of Cambridge's due date has been and gone, and we're still no closer to meeting our future monarch. Of course, Will and Kate have kept us all guessing by not finding out the gender at the scan. Not that that's always 100% reliable. We've probably all heard tales of baby Darren spending the first months of his life in a room painted a confident shade of pink. Or baby Alexander hastily being renamed Alexandra. And to be honest, I'm never too surprised by those stories because the scan photos that I've seen bear more resemblance to the grainy pictures of the Loch Ness Monster than a little human baby. But of course, a lack of information hasn't stopped public speculation, particularly on the gender. And apparently there are other ways to work it out. I don't know if you've come across these. Some say you can tell from the shape of the bump. Without getting too personal, apparently more out front means it's a boy, and more evenly spread means it's a girl. Then there's the ring test. You take off your wedding ring and hang it on a piece of cotton over the mother's tummy. And if it moves in a circle, it's a girl. And in a straight line, it's a boy. Though I think some do say it's the other way around. And then some expectant mothers just know, don't they? I'm sure it's a boy. He's already violent and unruly. But of course, the obvious question for these kinds of tests are, do they work? And you'll always find some believers. Yes, it definitely works, because we did the ring test for our first child, and it went round in a circle, and it was a girl. Actually, it wasn't right for the second child, but yes, it works. In other words, about 50% of the time. We're guessing, aren't we, if we're honest? Might be fun. Might be interesting. Might be great for the bookmakers with the royal baby. But at the end of the day, we're still guessing. We're speculating. Even more so when it comes to what Will and Kate's child will actually be like. What colour eyes it'll have. Whether it'll be tall or short, fat or thin. Whether it'll be beautiful like its mother. Or have big ears like its grandfather. And it may well appear we're in a similar position when it comes to God. The verse we're looking at this evening, verse 18 of John chapter 1, divides pretty neatly into two. And the first half is totally non-controversial. Have a look at it with me. No one has ever seen God. Actually, the original is even more emphatic than that. Literally, it's God no one has seen, ever. Which is true, isn't it? Just like the royal baby, no one has ever seen God. I doubt anyone here disagrees. But when you think about it, that's a bit of a problem for religious people. Because how are we supposed to know what he's like? Or if he's even there at all? Left to ourselves, we're just guessing, aren't we? And so it's no surprise, perhaps, that there are so many different and contradictory religions in the world. Because people can say, I like to think of God as this, or I like to think of God as that. And one guess is as good as another. Who's to say which is right and which is wrong? If no one's ever seen God. I mean, it's funny how the version of God people believe in tends to be for the things they're for and against the things they're against. But who can say they're wrong? Seems all opinions are equally valid. And it's no wonder that many are agnostic, that they admit they don't know, or even say we can't know, or even that some are outright atheists. Because no one's ever seen God. So surely it's no surprise many say, for whatever reason, I can't believe in a God I've never seen. But it's also something which might cause us some anxiety when we really stop to think about it. Because what if we've got it wrong? What if God is there and is angry that we've ignored him? Or what if our version of God is wrong? What if we think he loves our singing? But actually, he just wants to be left in peace. What if he's offended by the call to prayer 5 times a day? What if he's actually a she or an it? I mean, it matters greatly because the stakes are so high when it comes to God. We're talking potentially at least, about heaven and hell, life and death, eternal consequences. And even for life this side of eternity, this lack of certainty has profound implications. Because it means it's impossible to be totally sure about some of the big questions of life. When you're at the graveside for the family funeral and someone says, "At least she's in a better place now," or, "I like to think he's looking down on us." Well, those are lovely thoughts. But how do you know? Or when you're in trouble, you've lost your job or had your heart broken or just feel desperately down and you cry out to God, how do you know that he's able to help or wants to or that he's even listening at all? Or when we object on moral grounds that MPs fiddle their expenses or journalists hack into people's voicemails or that paedophiles abuse children. But how do you know it's wrong? I'm not saying it's not. I think all of those things are awfully wrong. But how do you know if no one's ever seen God? So it's a totally non-offensive, non-objectionable statement. No one has ever seen God. But it's also deeply unsettling when we really think about its implications, because it leaves us totally in the dark. And so it's great news for us this evening that our verse doesn't end there. And yet what follows is a pretty outrageous claim. No one's ever seen God, but God, the one and only, who's at the Father's side, has made him known. See, there is a time when the speculation over the royal baby will come to an end, isn't there? It'll be when the Duchess of Cambridge goes into the Lindo wing of St. Mary's Hospital, Paddington, and gives birth. Now, I'm no expert, but I imagine they'll know pretty quickly if it's a boy or a girl. An announcement will go up on the gates of Buckingham Palace, and as the child grows up, we'll increasingly get to know what they're like. And at that point, the speculation and uncertainty can and will stop. At least it should. And what I want us to see this evening is that the Christian claim is actually pretty similar. No one's ever seen God, but God, the one and only, who's at the Father's side, has made him known. John's telling us that there was a day when God himself was born into our world. Look at verse 14. It puts the same idea in a slightly different way. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. It's talking about Jesus. The language is slightly mysterious in this first chapter of John, but as the book unfolds, it's obvious he's referring to Jesus here. He's the one being described as the one and only, as the Word. The one who was there in the beginning, before the universe existed, who was with God and who was God. The one through whom absolutely everything was made. The one who gives life and light. And verse 14 says that same Word became flesh. He became a human being and lived on our planet. Never seen God? Well, John's saying if you've lived at the right time and in the right place, you could have done. If this wasn't a church building in London in 2013, but the temple in Jerusalem in the early 30s AD, then you could have seen God walk in through that door. When the shepherds looked into that wrinkled face in the manger, they were looking into the face of God. John's saying that when we see Jesus, we see God as he really is. And that's not just a claim other people made about Jesus, but one he also made about himself. Later on in this book, one of Jesus' disciples says to him, "Lord, show us the Father." And Jesus replies, "Don't you know me? Anyone who's seen me has seen the Father." He's saying, if you've seen me, you've seen God himself. And that wasn't just a one-off claim or something he was misquoted on, because in the end, it's the claim for which he died. He was charged with claiming to be God, and he chose crucifixion rather than deny it. But in one sense, it's easy enough to make a claim like that, isn't it? Probably not to the same extent, but I'm sure we've all talked ourselves up a little bit at some point in our lives. In job interviews, in trying to impress a member of the opposite sex. Boxers are famous for doing it in the build-up to a big fight. Take Muhammad Ali, for example. Again and again, he would claim, "I am the greatest." And yet, there was one thing Muhammad Ali knew better than most. If you're going to talk about yourself in that way, you better be able to back it up in the ring. And that's something he did time and time again. Well, one of the remarkable things as you read through John's gospel is that Jesus didn't just make outrageous claims. He also backed them up with action. So there was this time when he said, "I am the bread of life." As essential to life as food. Now, who on earth speaks like that? But then again, who else had just fed 5,000 people with one little boy's packed lunch? On another occasion, he claims, "I am the resurrection and the life." What a thing to say at a funeral of all places. But then a few moments later, he went over to the tomb, spoke to the corpse, and brought it back to life. Now that's ridiculous, we might be thinking. You've got me in here to listen to a serious talk, and you're presenting miracles as evidence. But let me ask, what would you expect to happen if God really did walk into his world? Wouldn't we want him to prove his identity by doing things we can't do and can't explain? You see, we can't have our cake and eat it. It's hardly fair to demand proof and then to dismiss it as impossible, at least until we've investigated it. But another objection we might still have would be, we still haven't seen. All we've got is this, John's gospel. And yet I'd put it to you that we do believe things we haven't seen every day. And that physical sight is not the only rational and reliable way of believing things. So when Kate does give birth, whenever that is, I take it we'll believe the news, even before we've seen the baby for ourselves. Why? Because people we can trust have seen him or her and have passed on the information in a reliable way. And it's the same here. What we're drawing on in John chapter 1 and throughout his accounts is eyewitness evidence. Verse 14 again. The word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory. John's saying that he and his friends are people who really did see God, who met their maker. Now, as Orthodox Jews, they were the last people in the world to worship a human being as divine. And yet something persuaded them that this man really was God, that they should follow him, even die for him. And wonderfully, we can see and meet Jesus for ourselves as we read their eyewitness testimony. Well, there are two implications for us if all this is true, and we'll finish with these this evening. The first is, we can know. We can know. We can know the truth about God, and we can even know God himself. And I want to say that is really good news. Our generous and loving Creator wants us to know him. He's not playing some cosmic game of hide and seek. Rather, he's come into our world in a form we can relate to. We don't have to be in the dark about him, and we don't have to be in the dark about the big questions of life. And that is such good news, because while playing games in the dark might be fun as children, other things are much less fun to do in the dark, like walking along the cliff edge of life and death. But if Jesus is who he claims to be, we can gain certainty about many of those massive questions. And wonderfully, whereas I doubt many of us will have a personal relationship with the new prince or princess, even if we know lots about them, Jesus coming into the world means we can know God personally. As John put it in verse 12 of chapter 1, to all who received him, that's Jesus, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. You see, Jesus came not just to make God known by being born in a wooden manger, but so we can know God as our friend, as our Father, by dying on a wooden cross, taking the punishment we deserve. We can know God. And so let me encourage you, if you've never properly read an account of Jesus' life, to take home the booklet in your hands and investigate for yourself. Ask yourself as you read it, who is this man? But here's the second implication, and it's a bit more challenging. We should know. We should know. This verse, if it's true, means our own opinions about God are no longer all equally valid. Did you notice how John describes Jesus as the one and only? Now, Chesney Hawks can get away with that kind of language, but it's a bit awkward in our politically correct and pluralistic age, isn't it? And yet, if the claims about Jesus are true, we're no longer at liberty to say, I like to think of God as this, or I like to think of God as that. Imagine once the royal baby has been born, someone saying, I like to think it's a girl, when it's clearly a boy. Or arguing that the wedding ring definitely went round in a circle. Or addressing them as Princess Stacy, when actually he's been publicly named as Prince Gavin. Be a bit weird, wouldn't it? You see, there's no need or place for speculation. The truth is now readily available. And similarly, if Jesus is who he claims, and our view of God is different, well, surely that will need to change. And in fact, as we look at and listen to Jesus, we may well be surprised. Because he says God isn't pleased by some of the things we often think are guaranteed to put a big smile on his face. Just trying to be good or religious, for example. We'll consider that more, a bit more next week, if you can join us. Or imagine someone after Kate's given birth saying, we can't know about the royal baby. Or even, I don't think she was even pregnant. That'd be ludicrous, wouldn't it? When the baby has decisively entered our world. You see, atheism, which seems very plausible if no one's ever seen God, and agnosticism or relativism, which sounds so humble and politically correct, are actually little more than rudeness if God's introduced himself. If I were to stand at the back after this and hold out my hand and say, hello, my name's Mark, and you just ignored me and walked past, well, that'd be pretty rude, wouldn't it? It'd be much more serious to do that to the royal baby in 50 years' time or whenever they're king or queen. But how much more serious to do that to the God of the universe, who made us, who gives us every breath we take, and who has introduced himself, made himself known, in Jesus. You see, if Jesus is who he claims, he's someone we really should pay attention to and get to know. And so let me encourage you again to take home this account of Jesus' life and read it for yourself. God's not hiding. That's the unique but outrageous claim of Christianity. And so we don't need to stay in the dark. There might be reasons we want to stay in the dark, and we'll think about that in a couple of weeks' time. But God's not hiding. He's come into our world in history and made himself known. Can't believe in a God you've never seen? Well, the good news is that God, the one and only, who's at the Father's side, has made him known. That as we see Jesus in the pages of John's Gospel, we can see and know God as he really is.